This is CliffCentral.com.
Hello and welcome to Animal Central on CliffCentral.com. As you all well know, this is the only show in South Africa dedicated to animals and the people that love them. I'm your host, Ainsley Hay. And we have a very interesting topic that we're going to be speaking about today. I think it's something that is a lot more common than we realize. It's something that affects animals. It's something that affects people as well. And I think, as I said, it's something that is a lot more common than we realize. And it's something that really affects our pets' quality of life. So I'm joined in studio today by the brilliant Dr. Niels du Plessis. Hello, Niels. Welcome.
Hi, Ainsley. Thanks for having me here. And yes, I think this is a very, very interesting and important little topic.
It is, completely. So first of all, you're a specialist surgeon from Fourways Veterinary Hospital, correct?
Yeah. So I specialized in surgery. I have done my normal veterinary degree.
Yes.
And then I spent another 6 years specializing in small animal surgery.
Oh.
And one of the things we do see on a very regular basis is specific little thing you're going to be talking
yes.
about. Yes. And that is arthritis in a lot of our pets, dogs and cats.
Yep.
And the effect that that has on the quality of life and what we can or cannot do about it for them.
Definitely. So let's go to the word arthritis first. What does arthritis mean?
Well, Ainsley, is essentially a combination of two things. Arthro, which is essentially means joint.
Okay.
Itis, which is always a little thing that indicates inflammation.
Okay.
So it's inflammation of a joint or joints. And inflammation is painful as a rule.
Okay.
There's the signs of inflammation, which is pain and redness and swelling and heat.
Okay.
And loss of function. And whether you cut yourself or scratch yourself and that little area becomes red and inflamed and tender to the touch, essentially a similar process that happens in joints.
Okay.
And that's why these joints become sore, and that's why they become inflamed, and that's why dogs don't want to use them, or animals don't want to use them.
Huh. Wow, yeah. So I think, because arthritis is quite a general term that's used. Is that right?
Yeah, arthritis is a very general term, and there's various causes. I mean, it could be anywhere from, you know, medical issues, and that's what we call immune-mediated arthritis type things, where the body's immune system launches a reaction against its own joints.
Oh, dear.
Then there's what we most often more see is called degenerative joint disease.
Yes.
So it just means that and that's usually more your older dogs, or, you know, there's a different trigger for it. But it's usually more joints that just over time don't function as well.
Okay.
And it's, you know, often like anyone who's been a little bit old, and you start getting a creaky joint and a sore joint, and you do something and that joint's a little bit sore. It's a wear and tear thing often.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a consequence of something else.
Okay. So that you touched a bit on are those the main causes of arthritis in our pets?
I think probably the ones we see the most is probably, and that's what I see, you know, in practice. I don't see that many of the medical cases, but I see a lot of the surgical cases. And a lot of those cases, the underlying cause is essentially either these little dogs that are born and grow up with joints that don't develop properly.
Okay.
And because they don't develop properly, these joints become abnormal and sore at a very young age. Or you get your older dogs, that's just a wear and tear thing. You know, they've been running around and bouncing their whole lives, and suddenly things start becoming
little old labbies.
There we go. And then we do see the odd ones that's got, you know, a trauma as a trigger.
Cause.
But those are actually relatively few and far between. Those are the motor car accidents that damage your joint specifically and that type of thing.
Okay.
So I think the cases that I see, or the patients that I see mostly, is essentially either your older dogs, just really just because of age associated issues. And then you have the dogs that's got congenital issues, but from a young age, like hip dysplasia or elbow issues, that's got a bit of a genetic, you know, part to it and a bit of a food part to it. And as these dogs grow, these joints don't develop properly and they start causing problems from a young age already.
And do you think that the incidences of arthritis in these younger dogs with the sort of hip dysplasia type things, do you think it's the incidences are increasing, or do you think our diagnosis and awareness is more?
Unfortunately, I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword. I think the incidence is definitely increasing. I think that's got to a large degree to do with we as man has changed the dog essentially from something that's about a 20-odd kilo, 25-kilo wild dog to anything that weighs from 1.5 kilo adult size, usually your little Yorkies, to something that goes over 100 kilos, which is a Great Dane. And unfortunately, the more we start changing these things, the more the growth problems start coming in. And I think we're probably seeing more. There are some breeds that's cleaned up the act quite a bit.
Okay.
That we're actually seeing, or I'm in practice in the NHO seeing a bit of a drop
In
incidence. But then you get your newer breeds, like, for instance, the Burbles, your giant breeds, that since they've been given, like, registration, you can actually see there's been an increase now. Because what happened is the people are breeding for these massive big dogs with the massive big heads, and their joints are going. No one is looking after them. And then you're getting, like, to your Rottweilers and your German Shepherds and your Labbies to a degree, where there's a lot of effort that's been put into screening these dogs and trying to breed what we can,
healthy animals,
screening as healthy as we can. And we do definitely see that, you know, our risk drops there.
Yes.
But once again, genetics is the throw of a dice. I mean, you can have perfect parents and still have trouble. Yeah. But it's the best that we can do.
Yeah. No, that is very true. So when we're talking about arthritic joints, I think let's focus, because am I right that arthritis happens with cats as well?
Yeah, by all means. Cats, we don't see that commonly, because cats are light. They're, as a rule, a bit more agile, and they tend to hide things better.
Okay.
But yes, there are some studies that show that probably about 70-80% of cats over 6 or 7 years of age will have some form of arthritis. They just hide it.
Yes.
And cats are very often active, more in the evenings, more at night. We don't necessarily see them.
Yeah.
And yes, it may be something as simple from suddenly he's just not jumping
onto the counter
anymore, but jumping onto a chair, or, you know, so these minor little changes in behavior that slowly but surely creeps in. And I think that's probably part of the big issue with this, is a lot of these things are slow, small changes that creep in over time, and people don't notice it until you actually start managing that pain. And suddenly you see, but just this animal suddenly is
happier,
jumping again,
he's
happy again, and he joins in
got quality of life again. Yeah,
there we go.
But now let's, okay, if we're talking about dogs, so when we say joints, which are the most common joints that are affected by arthritis with dogs?
I think in dogs, we're probably looking at front legs, we're looking at elbows, back legs, we're looking at hips and knees, more than anything else. So those are probably the three most common.
Okie dokie. So then we talked, you said a little bit about the symptoms of inflammation, and obviously we can't see those symptoms within the joint, unlike, as you say, when we cut ourselves. So what are the other symptoms that our pet owners and pet lovers can look out for, and what are sort of very good hints that the animals may be suffering from a bit of arthritis?
Angela, I think the most obvious one is an obvious limp or obvious lameness, or you see your dog's gait is uneven, or they lift a leg when they stand. I think those are the fairly obvious ones. What you will often see in puppies with joint problems that's painful is that although they'll play, I'll often have clients that say, but this dog will usually be in the middle and other dogs will be running around them. You know, they often don't participate in play as much. Or what you may see is if they do, for some reason, because the moment the excitement goes, they get adrenaline and endorphins and everything blocks the pain and they just go. And once that's settled down, they say, now we saw.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you may notice that they're a bit stiff in getting up.
Okay.
You know, that type of thing. But the puppies, it's often, I get people say, the moment we start managing pain, suddenly he's playing again.
Wow.
And with your older dogs or your even cats, it becomes very, very difficult because it's a slow onset thing. Often, I'm not talking about the joint that's suddenly injured, it's obviously sore. But it's small things from, you know, a little bit stiff getting up, you know, in the mornings, you know, then people tend to see that, you know, they warm up a little bit. So they get going in a few minutes and the dog appears a bit more comfortable. I think that's probably the most subtle thing.
Okay, so those are some of the common things, and I think that's such a common sight to see an old dog struggling to get down or struggling to get up, and I don't think owners make a connection that that's actually painful. I think they think, oh well, he's old and he struggles a bit, but you know, there's things that we can do to help dramatically with that. I mean, if you think of yourself, if you've got something like a back pain, which us as as veterinarians and veterinary nurses know all too well. Yeah, it's a continual sort of thing, and it's not something that's very enjoyable to live with. And I think modern veterinary medicine has progressed amazingly lately, and there's all sorts of amazing things that you can do. So maybe we should speak a bit about that. What are some of the different modalities that are used to help with arthritis? And is there a difference between, say, if it's a young animal with arthritis or an older animal with arthritis?
I always say this, the earlier we can pick it up, the better. Okay. Specifically dog with hip and elbow problems, because at a young age, while joints develop, we can often, either through surgery or through modifying lifestyle, make a difference. But when we look at management of the classic middle-aged sore animal, it's essentially hinges on, I always say, pain management number one, lifestyle management.
Okay, that's very important.
And that's often what people don't get, and dogs unfortunately also don't, because you take pain away, they want to go and play. And if you have sore joints, you take pain away and you go and play on them or bounce on them or do funny things on them, you're going to be sore afterwards.
Yeah.
Then we're looking at lifestyle. I would also include weight management, which in dogs makes a dramatic difference as far as overweight dogs is concerned, and cats as well, as far as pain management is concerned. Then we look at rehabilitation.
Okay.
And rehabilitation, I think we're fortunate at the moment that over the past few years, animal rehabilitation is starting to take off quite a lot, which is essentially almost like physiotherapy, but you know, we're not allowed to call it physiotherapy. there's a lot of work is now going into hydrotherapy, swimming exercises. There's physiotherapeutic modalities that can be used in to try and give these animals some pain control. There's exercise programs that can be worked out for all the animals that reduces impact, that helps to keep joints mobile. You know, that type of thing. And then nutrition, I think, also plays a fairly large role. There's extremely good diets on the market these days that target joint disease and joint pain. And most of those diets are a very gentle way of giving a significant amount of pain relief.
Wow.
To these animals.
And I mean, how easy is that? So it's actually included in the dog food that you feed your dog every single day.
It's included in the dog food. So there's some of your omega fatty acids.
Okay.
We talk about omega 3 and omega 6, and it's about the ratio and the amounts that's included in these food that targets that as an anti-inflammatory action on joints.
Wow.
Some of these foods do have some cartilage precursors in, what we call food supplements that's supposed to help joints remain healthy. A lot of these things is as easy as just changing the diet, bringing the weight down a bit, and modifying lifestyle. And often we can give a significant amount of pain relief by just doing a few simple things.
And am I correct that even one of these foods has actually made the dog food that has the joint supplements and all of that, and it's got a weight loss factor to the food as well.
Yep.
So it's ticking all the boxes.
It's ticking absolutely all those boxes.
I mean, that is easy. I wish I had something like that for me, if I'm perfectly honest.
I think all of us wish for that little miracle.
Yeah,
that's
man.
For sure. I think they should start packaging out food for
completely.
Us as well.
Oh no, I'll be the first one there. Yeah. So the joint supplements, I think there's a lot that's available. Mm. Is there any control over whether they are good, rubbish?
I think the joint supplements, and this is my opinion, and I may get crucified for it, but
it's okay. It's an experience and qualified opinion.
There's not a huge amount of physical science backing it up. We know what cartilage contains. A cartilage is essentially like a big sponge that's got like a little protein network and contains water. So it gives it a bit of a bounciness, and then there's little cells that live in there that keep things healthy. Mm-hmm. And we know those little protein bundles and things are made up of certain things. And the theory is that some of these supplements contain the building blocks of that cartilage.
Okay.
So you feed it to the dog and it should be absorbed. So in theory, okay, it should help this. There's also some of those things that do contain something like green lip muscle extract, mm-hmm, that has have some anti-inflammatory, mm-hmm, action. That's been proven. But science-wise, there's not a huge amount backing it up. Okay. But we're looking at, if we look at evidence-based medicine,
yes,
there's two sort of like legs. The one is science-based and the, mm-hmm, one is evidence-based. Mm-hmm. So science tells you, I can tell you on a molecular level exactly why this works.
Mm-hmm.
Evidence-based says, I cannot necessarily tell it why it works, but the evidence points to the fact that,
okay,
it does work.
Okay.
So in some patients, we do have evidence that some of these supplements do seem to,
okay,
help. I think people just need to be extremely careful about what they buy and need, mm, to stick to a reputable company.
Yeah.
Because every 6 months there's a new one coming on,
yes,
the market, and,
yeah,
and this one's got that, and this one's got,
yeah,
the flavor of the month drug. But I think they do have the potential to help, and I don't think there's a huge amount of potential to do harm.
Well, that's good.
But stick to a well-known, okay, manufacturing company.
So it would be a good recommend if a vet stocks it, that would be a very sound.
Yeah, that would probably be
your best option.
Bigger. I mean, we stock, I think, about 3 products in,
okay,
the practice, and we try and stay to reputable brands.
Yes.
And stuff that we have a bit of background,
okay,
in. And I always say if the budget allows it, by all means do it.
Yes,
it's,
okay,
not going to do any harm. It doesn't,
that's
have the
good,
potential to do good.
But if you were on a limited budget, it would be far more recommended to do the proper diet, you would say.
I would spend, yeah, my money on the, okay, proper diet, because the moment you spend your money on the proper diet, some of these diets that has been proven as a diet, scientifically, clinically, in trials, that reduces your need for pain medication,
wow,
dramatically.
That's amazing.
So what you're now doing is you're not only giving your animal pain relief, and it's out for cats as well,
mm-hmm,
and dogs.
Okay.
You're not giving them pain relief in a very gentle way. But you actually, if you deduct the price of what your pain medication, mm, would have cost you from the price of that diet,
okay,
it becomes a very cheap diet.
Wow.
So yeah, if I've got money for one thing and one thing only, it's,
yeah,
change diet,
okay,
first of all.
Okay, no, that's very good advice, because obviously there are repercussions of sort of long-term use of pain medicine as well.
Yeah, look, I think with pain medication is what's the lesser of the evils.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I think almost all of the pain medication that we do use long-term.
Mm. Because this is a long-term condition. It's there to stay. Is it reversible at all?
No, arthritis,
okay,
once you have it, that's it.
Okay.
It is a continuous process. It's not reversible. It's not curable.
Mm-hmm.
But what we try and do, we try and manage it. We,
okay,
try and limit the amount of damage, and we try and limit the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, unfortunately, as with all medication, and that's why even in human pain medication, there was one or two drugs a few years ago that were taken off the market, because,
okay,
it showed that in humans using it long term, it increases the chance of cardiovascular disease, mm, like heart attacks.
Okay.
The downside is, and as you as well said, most of us do, who's in the veteran profession, do have,
yeah,
some sort of back issues and pain issues, is that
you've got to manage
it.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, what is the consequence,
exactly,
of chronic,
yeah,
pain? There's no quality of life.
Yep.
In humans, it gives you rise to depression and,
mm,
lots of nasty side effects. So, mm, it becomes a lesser of the evils.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do try and do when we do put these animals on long-term treatment, and long-term treatment I mean every day of their lives,
mm-hmm,
year in, year out, because without it they are,
mm-hmm,
in pain, without, mm-hmm, it they have no quality of,
yeah,
life, is we do try and monitor, we do try and keep an eye on what their liver values and,
mm-hmm,
you know, what the liver function is like,
mm-hmm,
what the kidney function is like, and we do at least twice a year, in some cases even up to 4 times a year. We draw a bit of blood and,
okay,
just check the function of these organs,
because
those are essentially the organs that metabolize these drugs,
mm-hmm,
and excrete them. But once again, as I told, I've told many a client, I said, I would rather have 10 years of pain-free,
yeah,
life than it being chronic, constant pain. I,
yep,
can't do anything. And that's what often then ends up in these animals being put to sleep,
yep,
because they,
yeah,
do not have quality of,
exactly,
life.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I think at the end of the day is,
yeah,
the lesser of the evils.
And I think that's one of the most important things with something like arthritis. So if your pet is diagnosed with arthritis, you need to realize that you need to be a very responsible owner, and it's, mm, you walk the path sort of with hand in hand with your vet.
Yep. I think with this type of thing, you've got to be very knowledgeable. And my approach is always I sit my clients down and I have a piece of paper and I draw pictures for them and I explain to them how it works and I explain to them what cartilage is like and how that works. And I try and get them to understand what is happening and then to get them to understand what my aims are with treatment.
Okay.
And then it's a process that I walk with them that we start the dog or the cat on a specific type of treatment, and we see what the effect is.
Okay.
And we modify the lifestyle. We get them into a rehabilitation program. We try and modify the food. So we add quite a few things together, and then we see clinically how this pet does. And the owner is unfortunately often the best judge.
Yes.
And they will often get back to you and say, yeah, and suddenly he's playing, and suddenly he's this, and suddenly he's that. And once we get things to settle down, then we start tapering the program a bit. We taper the rehabilitation program. We taper the medicines a bit. We drop the ones that are potentially a bit more worse than the other ones.
Okay.
And we try and get down to a maintenance level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's either medication or just food and rehabilitation
or,
you know, whatever is needed.
Okay.
And a lot of those owners, once they walk that path, they actually start managing these animals themselves. They start knowing. It's like I've told people, don't take your 80-year-old granny that's got arthritis and expect her to go and play rugby or netball or whatever with a 15-year-old and then expect her not to
exactly.
And people's going to make that mind switch.
Yeah.
And then start taking ownership of it. Start understanding the process, understanding what's happening, and then get back to me. It's a consultation.
Okay.
It's a continuous feedback process. And we taper and we change. We taper and we change. And we monitor. And we try
that's
and
brilliant.
Give those animals as pain-free life as we can.
And that's so important. I mean, listeners, it's not seeing a dog struggling to get up or get down or running on three legs or, you know, you can see that they're obviously lame. They're not lame because they feel like it. They're not lame because they know you're going to give them more treats. Or they're smart, but no, it's because they are in pain. And pain, chronic pain is a really horrible thing to live with. So I think it's very, very important that we're having this talk and we're getting this info out there because it affects a lot more animals than I think people realize. So you talked about the weight loss aspect. I think that's also something that's very important. And it's often a very difficult thing to speak about to owners in practice. Because, because I mean, a lot of us, including myself, are completely in denial. And the thing about our animals is that I think a lot of animals nowadays are actually overweight.
No, I unfortunately think so. So what we've started doing, I've got a little picture on the wall of my consult room, and there's pictures of different dogs in different, you know, stages of weight gain. And you actually take, I actually take the owner or the parent, and some of them are there, and I say, okay, look here. There's your dog.
Yeah.
There's the pictures. Where would you place your dog?
Okay.
And that gives them a body fat percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And often that just helps, you know, sort of just saying your dog's fat.
Yes. They've actually got a comparison that
they can
see.
Something that they could work against. And yes, I always say if there's nothing wrong, a little bit of extra weight is probably not an issue at all. The problem is the moment you have painful joints now, that weight starts making
A
major hassle.
Yeah.
So, and then it's down to the point that they have to make the decision. Do you want an overweight, very painful dog?
Yeah.
Do we want to drop that weight and know if we can drop 30% of that weight, 70% of the pain is going to go away?
Yep. That's a very good way of putting it.
You know, fairly straightforward.
Wow.
So you decide. Do you want to kill them with kindness?
Yeah.
Or do you want feeding them treats? And unfortunately, it's always but the husband, and the wife, and the kid.
The stories that you hear. It's absolutely. No. I promise you. He only gets 4 kibbles in the morning, 3 at lunchtime, and then, and treats. You know, he gets a bag of drivors every day.
There we go.
And I think there's been.
And daddy gives a bit of. Gives a bit of
biscuit. And then a rusk in the morning. Morning, all of it. And I think there's been, listeners, if you go in Google, I think there's been some amazing comparative charts saying basically the equivalent if you give your dog one Simba Chippy. That's the equivalent, because we think of, a lot of us, including myself, anthropomorphize our children and see them as humans. And you don't think, for you to eat a Simba Chippy is nothing, but for your dog and your dog's size, it's actually a huge. So if you they eat a Simba Chippy, it's the same as you eating a whole burger or whatnot.
Exactly.
So there's just do yourself a favor and Google it and see the comparative, because you don't think, you think, oh, it's just one chippy, man. Come now, it doesn't make a difference, but it does make a difference. No, but I think, you know, and it's quite funny because I'm very strict with my dog's weight. I've got a little French bulldog, mm-hmm. Gus, love of my life, mm-hmm. but I keep him very lean.
There we go.
Very lean. You can feel his ribs. He's got a little floating rib. So everyone touches him and says, oh my God, your dog's so thin. I said, nah. He's very well muscled. Yeah. And he's actually in this is perfect body condition. Because yeah. most Frenchies you see are little tubs of lard. They're humongous. And they're prone to spinal problems and all the other
breathing issues.
Exactly. And so that just exacerbates everything that these animals go through. So if you love your animals, I think it's very important that you do have a serious talk to yourself about their weight and get some professional advice.
Yep. And I think one of the other big mistakes, and this is weight and food included, mm-hmm. is specifically when these little dogs or cats are very well, specifically dogs, cats mm-hmm. not that much, but specifically your larger breed dogs, mm-hmm. is when they're young, is people overfeed them.
Yes.
Overfeed them. You get these puppies and, oh, but it's just puppy fat. Oh, what is this? And I mean, there's research that's shown if that puppy gets the incorrect food or overfed between the age of 6 to 8 weeks,
yeah.
that has potential consequences for
really?
His joints as he grows up.
So from the early stage of
six to eight weeks, 2 weeks of incorrect feeding can have consequences.
That'll affect him for the rest of his life.
Of his life on his joints. And I think that's why it's extremely important is get your vet involved from a very early age. There are some of these things, like for instance, early hip problems. I mean, I can pick up potential hip problems on puppies as young as 4 months of age. Now, I'm talking about Labby, your larger breed puppies. And at that age, there's a huge amount that we can do.
Wow, okay.
From both a surgical perspective as well as a rehabilitation perspective. That's going to make a massive difference to that dog for the rest of his life. So what you're doing is that first year, you're investing in the rest of his life.
Oh, that's a wonderful way of putting
it. So if you stuff it up there,
the
rest of his life is bearing the consequences of carrying the consequences.
And not only is your dog going to be in pain, your dog's going to have a limited life.
Exactly.
Your pocket's going to feel it as well.
Exactly. Because now you're starting to pain medication.
Yep.
You're starting to do this and that. And you're starting 20, 30, 40, 50 bucks a month. Just not a month, a day.
Exactly.
Just on medication to keep pain levels under control. So I would really advise the people, get your vet involved from very first vaccination consultation.
Sure. Yeah.
The second one, the third one. If it's a large breed or at-risk breed, we can do a little test that we can just check for it. Yeah, that young age, we talk about hip laxity. And
okay.
It says the hip is a ball and socket joint, and it should fit nice and snug.
Yes.
And in some of these dogs, these joints are just loose.
Yeah.
They literally almost pop in and out. And if at that age we already pick up a problem,
jeez.
They're starting to term the coin juvenile hip dysplasia now already. So if between 4 and 5 months I pick up there's a problem, we can make a major difference at that age. Because now already we're starting to manage dog's weight, we're starting to manage his diet, we try and get him into maybe a rehabilitation, a swimming program, developing his bum muscles. There's a very simple surgery that we can do that helps the hips to develop better at that age.
Okay.
Once we go over 5 months, we've lost that window.
Wow.
Then we're looking at major surgery later if surgery is going to help, or we're looking at a hip replacement, or we're looking at lifetime management of pain. So,
jeez, but I suppose that also brings a whole new burden onto these people that breed animals and sell animals, because now everyone knows I'm not the biggest fan of breeders. I will say this till the day that I die, because I mean it. But now, not only if you're going to go and buy a puppy from a breeder, not only are you entrusting that breeder has vaccinated the puppy properly, which they often do not, has dewormed the puppy properly, but also now that it has fed the puppy properly, especially if it's a large breed. Because what was that gap? You said 5 to 6 weeks?
6 to 8 weeks.
Six to eight weeks. So decent breeders, the puppy should be with its mom until 8 weeks. Owners shouldn't be getting puppies before 8 weeks for their social development and all of that. So now, not only if you're going to buy a dog from a breeder, are you more than likely going to get a dog possibly with parvo, but a dog with hip dysplasia or a dog with joint problems? And that's my opinion and mine only.
No, I understand that. I think the main thing is this, if people do go out and they are good good breeders out there, but specifically at at-risk breeds.
Yes.
And those are usually your Labradors, your Shepherds, okay. your larger breed dogs, is ask for a grading. There's a grading system that goes in a lot of these dogs. Elbows are graded, hips are graded.
Okay.
It's registered with the Kennel Union of South Africa. Now, mm-hmm. they don't control breeding, but they just register it.
Mm.
So they get certified. And there's a scale that those parents are certified on as far as excellent hips to bad hips, as far as excellent elbows to bad elbows. And if you have a breeder that's doing the best they possibly
okay.
can, they will be open with all that.
And they'd have all that information because they would want to be breeding the healthiest dogs possible.
Exactly. And unfortunately, when we take a look at this type of thing, we talk about genotypic and phenotypic.
Okay.
Now, genotypic is what the animals carries in their genes. And
mm-hmm.
we don't have a way of targeting hip dysplasia, elbow dysplasia yet. There are a lot of gene tests now, like eye problems, that we can pick up from a genetic test, so we can prevent breeding animals with that in totality. I've got like Australian cattle dogs, and they suffer from retinal atrophy.
Yes.
So we now got a DNA test that tests the parents, that say parents are clear, parents are carriers, parents are affected. So you now know exactly who you breed to who. What your offspring is going to be. So you're not breeding offspring that's going to go blind at 5 or 6 or 7 years of age. You can now breed offspring that will never go blind.
Ooh, okay, that's brilliant.
Unfortunately, with hips and elbows, we don't have it yet.
Okay.
So what we can do is these dogs get x-rayed when they're skeletally mature, usually about a year and a half of age. These x-rays is sent away to a certified radiologist.
Mm-hmm. Someone, and this would be the mom and the dad of the puppy.
Mom and the dad. And then they get a certificate that says, this is the quality of the hips, this is the quality of the elbows, and there's a grading system there. And then there's guidelines that say you may not breed this grade to that grade. And it's to try and breed out a lot of these problems.
Okay.
And if you have a good breeder, they will be very open with the mm-hmm. parents' histories.
Mm-hmm.
And they will give that to you up front. And yes, as I said, genetics is a throw of the dice. But currently, that's the best we can do. So we can screen the parents on what we see, not necessarily on what they carry. But it's also then very important that breeder gets feedback.
Yes.
If there's a problem with
from
them,
the pups,
and that's usually where I've got the biggest issue with some breeders, is they don't like that.
Oh, dear.
They don't like that because suddenly it reflects on my dogs and.
Oh.
Because, unfortunately, like hips and elbows is what's called a multifactorial disease. So genetics play a role, food play a role, and environment play a role. You know, a lot of them will hide behind, I've had one breeder I know, and their little thing, it says, every care is taken with the hips, but, these two factors also, we don't take any responsibility for hip problems.
And that's dirty.
That's rubbish.
That's dirty.
That's absolute rubbish.
So
that's the only way we can eradicate or at least reduce the incidence. Like I said, there are some breeds that are really cleaning up the act.
Good. That's very good to hear.
Yeah.
Sure, that's very good to hear. And we will be back shortly.
Download the Cliff Central app. Available now on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store.
Okay, so we're back now. I'm joined in studio by the great Dr. Niels du Plessis. He is a specialist surgeon from Fourways Veterinary Hospital. We are having an absolutely fascinating conversation about arthritis in pets. I'm learning an awful lot, and I hope that you are too, listeners. So I think one of the other tools used to help especially dogs with arthritis is surgery, and we haven't really spoken about that in any detail. So you want to tell us a bit about the options there?
Yeah.
Where to start?
I think unfortunately a lot of the surgery for arthritic issues is what we call salvage procedures.
Okay.
Unless we pick up some of these problems at a very young age, surgery essentially becomes a salvage thing.
Mm.
In other words, it's not necessarily going to give them a pain-free life, but it should be a less painful life than what they otherwise would have had. So for us, in the very young puppies, large breed puppies between 4 and 5 months of age, there's a little procedure where we can actually change the growth of the pelvis. It's called the juvenile pubic symphysiodesis. It's a fairly fancy word, but juvenile just means young.
Mm-hmm.
Pubis is the bottom almost what we call the suture line of the pelvis.
Pelvis, okay.
The symphysis is that little growth center there.
Okay.
And desis just means that we're stopping growth there. So because the pelvis is a box, it grows essentially symmetrically. So if we can stop the bottom part of the growth, we actually force the top part to cover the hips better. So that's something that we can do that makes a major difference. And then in some of the other younger dogs, specifically with elbow problems, we can open those little elbow joints up and take little problems out, and that will help long-term to improve it. With hips as well, there's a procedure called a triple pelvic osteotomy. Mm-hmm. We actually go and cut three parts of the pelvis and we twist the whole hip joint to give the hip better coverage. And then when you get to older dogs, you're starting looking at joint replacements now.
Okay.
And joint replacements in animals is really taking off. I think hip replacements has been sorted out mostly.
Okay.
And I think the success rate there is fairly high, probably about 90%.
Wow.
Elbow replacements is coming online, but there's still lots of kinks to iron out there. Knee replacements are coming in.
Okay.
There's still some kinks to work out there. So we're working on it. Unfortunately, these procedures are, as a rule, quite expensive.
Yes.
All these implants are medical grade. They come all of them coming from either United States or from Europe.
Sure.
But these things are available now for getting out there. From a surgery point of view, that's probably about the limit.
Okay.
So once again, just try and prevent it. Try and manage it.
And then are surgeries like that generally covered by pet insurance? Is that an option?
Some of these, I think there's about three pet insurance companies now that we use. One of them is like a pet medical aid, and they cover a specific amount. They say we've got a contracted in fee, and for this procedure, we'll cover X amount.
Okay.
There's other two other pet insurance or medical insurance company, and they give you a global amount per year that you can use. So they will cover, depends on how much those surgeries are and what your limit is. They may cover most of it or part of it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Unfortunately, I don't think those things are within anyone's budget.
No. And I think it's so heartbreaking because you see it so often in practice, and people come in with their Labrador puppy, 6 months old, well, maybe not Labradors now that they're cleaning up. But, you know, it's absolutely heartbreaking when you think you've got a bright future ahead with your dog and you realize that it's got such serious problems.
I think for me, the worst part about it is I sometimes have to put very young puppies to sleep because they come in there, they're 8 months old, and the hips are gone, the elbows are gone, their knees are giving problems.
What chance do they have?
And you've got a dog that's going to have an adult weight of 70 or 80 kilos.
It's never going to make
the rest of his life ahead of him. So, yes, some of these conditions we can help. We can help a lot. But if you start getting all four legs affected, people are going to think very carefully where they want to go.
Yeah.
Even these young labbies with bad hips, if we manage them well, we know we're going to get most of them fairly pain-free by about a year and a half of age. But that still means it's about a year's worth of putting in effort.
Uh-huh.
And then usually they're doing fairly okay. And as they get older, you start having problems again. But I think our success with managing a lot of these cases is, I think, fairly good. But people have to be committed.
And it's active from the beginning.
Exactly. They have to commit. They have to be in there. And they have to know it's a lifelong process. Mm. It's a lifelong responsibility. It's not just,
it's not like, today I won't give him his tablets, or we missed
you
a couple of weeks
to
his
be
tablets.
On top of it. You have to be on top of it every single
day. And it's dreadful because it's so common. I mean, I hate it. I take my boy Gus to Walk Haven often. I was actually there on Easter Monday. He had a big roll in the mud and smelled like a swamp donkey. And you can actually see, I have a very biased eye, obviously, and you can see these dogs with these hips, and they are just, you look at them and you just think, oh, goodness, oh, there's a whole world of badness there. Mm. Oh, and it is, I think it's amazing how much we have progressed with veterinary medicine and surgery and the options. I mean, obviously, I'm a bit rusty. I've been out of practice for a while, but I mean, flip, when I was practicing, there was we didn't think about elbow replacements.
Yeah.
So to hear that's starting.
I think elbow replacements at the moment, they say putting to sleep is the only other
option.
Because it's a complex joint. But I mean, these replacements are, if 10 years ago, hip replacements were very iffy. Hip replacements has been sorted out now.
Wow.
You know, success rate is extremely good. And we are getting there. It's a process.
Yeah.
It's a process.
And what about things? I heard about this recently. I think it's quite a new modality. What is your opinion on it? With stem cells and stem cell treatments.
That's an interesting one. I think my biggest issue with stem cells is there's a lot that they still need to know. I think from my point of view, what we do know about stem cells is that yes, it does seem, the treatment does seem to give some pain relief.
Okay.
But the pain relief is not because these stem cells goes into the joints and they miraculously regenerate these joints.
Okay.
The physical act of injecting these stem cells seems to have trigger a pain relief or anti-inflammatory reaction
in the
body.
Okay.
We do know that specifically putting stem cells into joints, like within about 36 hours, they're gone.
Really?
They've linked them to little radioisotopes and they're gone. So they don't go in there
and make a brand new joint.
But there seems to be some pain relief involved.
Okay.
And I think that's fairly important. I think it's a big step. In humans, they have gotten to the point where they can like grow certain little targeted things.
Okay.
But it's also still fairly
experimental.
It's very new. It's a process that you need to go through as far as harvesting. A lot of these companies work on fat. Now harvest a bit of fat. So it's a light general anesthetic. They harvest a bit of fat. This is sent off to a company. They then grow these cells out of that. They pass them on. They then send that back to your vet who then injects it. A lot of the stem cell therapies, they reckon, treatment should be done every 3 months.
Okay.
And I've had that client that has gone that route and then has given positive feedback. But like I said, most of it seems to be pain relief. It's not about growing a new joint or fixing a problem or that type of thing. I think maybe in a few more years when things are ironed out, I think it's got a brilliant possibility.
Okay.
There. I really do.
Great.
But there's just too much we don't
still
quite
early,
know yet.
Early, early days.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, let's start. So, I have a cat. Nubbin. Mm-hmm. Nubbin is an unknown age because I adopted her from an SPCA. What are some of the signs that I must look out for if I were to think that she was becoming arthritic? So if she doesn't, the first would be if she doesn't jump up and eat her cat food.
I think that's probably one of the first things you're going to see. If you do feed her from a height or you're going to find a less on the tables, a less on couches, that type of thing. That's probably one of the first things. She may also be a bit more prone to just lying around, being a bit, not lethargic, but just not that active.
Being cat-like.
There we go.
Being more of a cat than normal.
There we go. So the butler's now going to bring everything to it, you know, instead of it going to the butler.
Yes.
So I think those are the main things. And then, sometimes they may not groom as well as they can.
Okay.
It becomes a
That's
bit more painful now
one.
To bend that back and to
True.
Look and to do everything. They can have a little bit of muscle loss. But unfortunately, what often happens in these animals is the less active they become, the more obese they become.
Yes.
Which also makes it worse. So most of these things is essentially just a change, and it's usually a slow onset change just in demeanor.
And with cats, it's generally only the sort of obesity or old age induced arthritis. Do they get any genetical thingies going on?
Apart from the really weird and wonderful birth defects.
Nah. Okay. So the main thing would be in keeping the cat's weight down, which can be quite tricky. Mm-hmm. But luckily, most of your veterinary practices will have vet nurses, especially who do could possibly offer weight loss clinics, and they've got great suggestions on weight loss. I think weight loss with cats is a challenge.
Absolutely.
Especially my cat.
Absolutely.
So I think that's definitely that's definitely the first port of call if someone's worried about their cat, if they think that they may be.
I think if they think they may be, it's probably just get an appointment with your general vet. Just have them go through and have them just, what we usually do, we examine those joints, call it an orthopedic examination.
Okay.
So we just go through the major joints and just check what we call range of motion.
Mm-hmm.
Are the joints a little bit stiffer? Is it a little bit uncomfortable once you get to the limit of ranges? yes, we can radiograph some of these joints.
Okay.
And that's often a little bit, if your radiographs are good, you can see, you know, there's a bit of cartilage loss, a bit of cartilage collapse, a change there. Often the spine will start seeing small little changes between the vertebrae, small changes, elbows. I've often seen cats, if you take an x-rays and the elbows are quite markedly arthritic, and that's not why the cat came in for.
Oh.
You know, it's just the incidental finding.
Cats are stoic.
The they are.
Yeah.
And they light. As a rule, your smaller and your lighter animals tend to do a little bit better.
Okay.
Your heavy animals tend to struggle a bit more. And then if there's an obesity issue, obviously get, once again, your vet involved. We've got a weight loss clinic.
Yes.
So we have a dedicated girl who we refer these cases
Brilliant.
To. And she sits down with these clients and she discusses the whole diet with them. She does weigh-ins with them.
Great.
These people get feedback. They get back to her. They do a regular weigh-in. She gets a little graph for them. Because, you don't want to lose, a crash course in 2 weeks. You lost all the weight. You know, it's also not...
No, it's not good for their health.
No, definitely
for their
not. No,
and
definitely not. Definitely not.
Yeah.
So it's a guided process, and we try and guide them. And over 4 to 6 to even 8 months, just bring that weight down.
Yeah.
And then have a look at, is there medication-wise that we can use? First of all, once again, once the weight is down, specifically with cats, I would go the food route.
Yes. Okay, so there is the food as well with cats.
Absolutely. It's just with cats, we're very limited as far as pain medication.
Yes.
The pain medication is we don't have in cats in South Africa currently anything with long-term registration that we can use for pain.
Well, that's not good.
Yep, unfortunately. So what we do use some of these drugs because we do have international data that we use.
Okay.
In other words, UK data, where some of these drugs are registered for long-term use.
Okay.
So there is stuff that we can do from a pain or anti-inflammatory treatment point of view.
Okay.
But cats as a rule are a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
Seriously. They just don't metabolize drugs as well as dogs do. The kidneys are much more prone to having issues.
Mm.
So the same thing again, before we start long-term thing, we do a full health profile on them. We check kidney function, check liver function, and we on a regular basis keep an eye on that. And then what we will often see is your supplements in cats, I think, play a much bigger role than in dogs.
Oh, really? Okay.
Just because we don't have the range of treatment that we can use. Even hydrotherapy, getting a cat in the swimming pool.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Does that happen?
Oh, yes, it happens.
Do the hydrotherapists end up intact? Or they? I just imagine lots of bleeding and scratching and cursing.
Well, they actually got little like little life jackets that they can actually jacket the cat in. And some of them, once they get used to it, they
really
absolutely fine with it.
My cat would, she would disown me.
No,
oh, that's fascinating.
Not all cats take to it, but
it is an option.
Options are definitely there.
Sure. Yeah, I think, as you said, the physical therapy rehabilitation side of things is definitely...
I'm very excited about that. I'm really excited about that. I mean, if you take it on a human, how many of us have gone to a physiotherapist?
Mm.
You have surgery. And for many years, this has been neglected in the veterinary profession.
Mm.
Many years. And I'm very happy to say that there's a few very nice rehabilitation facilities now in the area that's opening up. That's actually... there's now some training programs.
Yes, that's exciting.
Can actually go through that. You know, there's some qualification behind
that.
There's actually within the veterinary profession now, there's a push to get that recognized as a sub field, veterinarian, vet nursing, to get a veterinary or a rehabilitation qualification.
Oh, so that'd also be para-veterinarians.
Para-veterinarian
Very
type
good.
Of thing. Either physios or nurses
That's
or whatever,
great.
And they all do a similar course. And so at least you've got some sort of control on what you get out there.
Mm.
But I tell you, I can see the difference. I mean, I'm not just talking about arthritis, guys. I'm talking about surgeries, you know, little Vosch monkeys with spinal problems after surgery. You see the difference in those patients if they've gone through a proper rehabilitation program
amazing.
Versus the one that's ones
that
don't.
Didn't.
Yeah, and
sure.
It's only once you start using this on a regular basis that you really
see
start
the rewards
seeing the value
of it.
To it and the reward of it. Yeah,
that's absolutely brilliant. I think it is something that needs to be done hand in hand. And I think with definitely it seems with dealing with this type of arthritis and these conditions, it is a very sort of interlinked way of treating. It's not just here's some tablets, boom. you'll be better.
Well, I call it, I don't know, holistic maybe. Is
yes, that's a good word.
It involves your vet. It involves medication. It involves the owner. It involves a rehabilitation. So there's a lot of things we bring together to give us a synergistic outcome.
Okay.
In other words, a 1+1=3 instead of 1+1=2. And everything does its own little bit.
Yes.
And with everything together, we're starting to get a much better picture, much better outcomes.
Oh, that's
and
brilliant.
We don't just start relying on just give this tablet
exactly.
every morning type
yeah.
of thing. There's other options now that you can explore. Yes, unfortunately, it is sometimes. You have to still give part of this tablet, but it's part of the tablet.
Exactly.
Not this whole tablet.
Yeah. No, so, and I think it's definitely something that you can involve the whole family with something like this, especially the physiotherapy, the rehab side, the weight loss side. And I think if you tackle it head on and you go in with the right attitude, you can really make it something
that can make amazing. I've had animals that's coming that people want to put down. That they just do not. I feel sorry for some of these
owners,
specifically some of these dogs and some of these owners, because these dogs are often they 8, 9, 10, 12 months old. They're part of the family.
Oh,
people get so attached to them, and suddenly they face the prospect of losing them.
Yeah.
And to see the difference that it makes, you see that same dog 2 months down the line, and suddenly he comes in and he wags his tail, and people are happy, and you get everything together, and suddenly things work. And
that's amazing.
That's probably some of the best experience you have.
Yeah.
Just see that difference.
That's absolutely amazing. Oh, I wish all dogs without riders could have happy endings like that. So I think we haven't spoken very much about spines and arthritis. We mentioned our bad backs, but we haven't quite got, and then we mentioned the cat's bad backs, if you see them stop grooming.
Yeah.
So do spines suffer from arthritis?
If you take a look at the spine, the spine is made up of different vertebrae.
Yeah.
And every little two vertebrae has got a little joint that allows you to turn your neck or up and down, side to side. And yes, we do get in those little joints, we do get little arthritic changes. Once again, unfortunately, it's one of these very vague type of things that you can't really pinpoint it to one little spot, you know, that type of thing. You often just get either dog or specifically cats that just don't do well and they're comfortable, and take x-rays and you do find it. And once again, it's a response to treatment more than anything else.
Okay.
So it is not, I think, high on the list. I think it's probably more underdiagnosed than anything else. I think we do pick up the bigger joints first.
Yes.
And the upside is that the management of the bigger joints will manage those little things. And also remember, animals walk on four legs. We walk upright. So I think with us, I think it's probably a bit more debilitating. I'm not talking about the little dachshunds with slip discs.
Yes, that's
different.
It's a completely
different story. But I think there's the different stresses and strains on their spine
than ours.
On ours.
Okay.
But yep, pain definitely adds.
Oh, yoy. So what are absolute no-nos for dogs that are arthritic? Well, definitely not keeping them overweight. That's a no-no.
Get the weight down.
Feed them proper food. Don't feed them rubbish.
There we go. Stop impact stuff.
Yes. So things that people don't realize, throwing toys.
Throwing ball and let the dog run and go and fetch it. I know they take them to the dog parks and they want to let them out and let them run. Remember, the moment that excitement hits, the dog blocks pain.
And they go
and they
full
go
tilt
full
and
tilt.
Then they're broken.
And then they're broken afterwards.
Yeah.
So for me, it is get the weights down. Stop the impact stuff.
Yes.
Do the gentle stuff. Do lots of walks. Go for 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 minutes walks.
Okay.
See how your animal responds to that, specifically with dogs. You know, cats, even cats you can take for walks. Some of them do learn to go on a collar. I think that's sort of like the main thing. Try and get swimming on board. Try and change a bit of lifestyle. In other words, cold surfaces. You know, if a dog is going to sleep outside now in the middle of the winter and it's arthritic, try and get it in a shelter.
You shouldn't have the dog if he's sleeping outside in the winter.
I know, but unfortunately that's the reality of life. You know, soft, padded, proper
bedding.
You know, pamper them a bit, cover them up. So, some of these old dogs do need a bit of extra care.
And a big bugbear of mine, and am I right with this? If you see these old dogs with these really long nails, if they have long nails, it's anine, poofy, and it can grow into their claw. But aren't you sometimes, you see these dogs and it's actually changing the angles, of their joints.
That's why I say anine.
Yeah.
Anine. You know, take any old person with arthritis in their little fingers, and now you take those fingers and you just bend them at an angle. And unfortunately, it's the chicken or the egg scenario, because they're not that active anymore.
Yes.
They don't wear their nails anymore. Yeah. The nails now start growing and the toes start curving in different directions and starts putting tension on these joints. So, keep those
definitely keep them trimmed. It's such a bugbear of mine, amongst others. So an interesting thing that I once heard, and tell me if I'm right, because to stop the impact, but if you have a very high toy driven dog, if you're at a dog park, say, and there is a very safe body of water with a very straight access point, so no steep whatever, if you throw that dog's, and it's a water loving dog and a dog that can swim, if you throw the dog's ball into the water and it retrieves from the water, that's better than on land. What are your thoughts on that?
No, definitely. I would much rather do water work than impact.
Land work.
Definitely. I think the nice thing about water work is there's very little impact on the joints. It works muscle,
yes,
so it burns energy, and it keeps joints mobile.
Okay.
And with a joint, mobility is life.
Okay.
Controlled mobility. As I said before, right in the beginning, remember, a joint is made up of two pieces of cartilage, two bones coming together, and it's got a piece of cartilage on either side, and that's got a little lining, and that's got a fluid in that lubricates that joint.
Yes.
Okay. Now, that little cartilage layer does not have a blood supply. It's got no little blood vessels to feed those little cells that keep the cartilage healthy. The only place they can get their food from us from the fluid in the joint.
Oh.
And the only way that fluid gets into the joint is if those little sponges are compressed. So they push out fluid and they suck in fluid. And push out fluid and they suck in fluid. And that's why it's important to keep joints mobile. That's one of the reasons. Because if you keep joints mobile in a controlled fashion, you've actually feed the cartilage.
Oh, isn't that clever?
All right. So, and that's the only way those little cells get their nutrients and everything, and that's the only way they keep that cartilage healthy. If you now take that and you impact it, pound it the whole time, and they're a little bit iffy, and then, because with any inflamed joint, the lubricating ability drops, the fluid becomes more watery, becomes a bit more acidic, so you're already sitting there in an environment that's not optimal and unhappy. Now you go and pound it.
That's not going to be good. No.
It's definitely not good. And that's a nice thing about, water work, is it gives you that movement without pounding, without impact. Also, what tends to happen with some of these joints when they become very arthritic is that lining, that capsule that secretes that lubricating fluid, actually starts stiffening up.
Oh, dear.
And that's why we get what we call limited range of motion.
Yes.
Suddenly the leg doesn't extend fully anymore and doesn't flex fully. And at the moment you get close, it becomes sore. Mm. Because now that joint capsule becomes what we call fibrotic. It becomes a bit, it becomes thickened.
Oh.
And now the joint can't move as much as it used to anymore. And once you get to that point, it starts pulling and the joint becomes sore. So the other thing that water works also helps, it helps with that joint mobility, to try and keep joint mobility up. It helps specifically in obese animals to burn energy, to burn calories, because once again, the same thing that happens. The moment the joints become sore, they don't want to walk all that much anymore. They don't want to play all that much anymore. Mom and dad doesn't feed less. You've got to get somewhere to burn energy. I'm very much for water work. Just be very careful. Like you said, a gentle entry, gentle out. So, because that's often where things can go wrong.
Exactly. Okay. So I think as we've covered, I think pretty much everything with arthritis, I'm certainly thrilled. I'm going to go home and give my cat a range of motion test and check her out. Yeah. Gus is fine. He's still a young whippersnapper who's relatively well-bred. Well, not well-bred, but he's put together quite well. I'm very lucky. But I think definitely we must stress that the first port of call is your vet.
Yeah, I really think you need to work, and whether it's your dog, whether it's your cat, it needs to be in conjunction with someone that can guide you.
Yeah.
Once you know the process, part of that management, I think the owner can take over very, very well. But it has to be a consultation process. It has to be. And that personnel, they need to understand what's going on. With
yes.
them. They need to be realistic about what yes. the expectations are. They must
yeah.
know. I'm not going to cure this.
Yeah.
But I can control his pain.
Yeah.
I can limit the long-term damage. I can give him some quality of life.
Mm.
Yes, there's a downside. He may need medication. That may have an effect long-term on organ function. Bottom line is you've got to decide.
Yeah. And I think definitely don't delay. If you get a slight inkling that you think your puppy's walking a bit funny or your old dog's slowing down a bit, I think it's very important that you rather be safe than sorry. Yeah. Take your animal in, see your vet.
Look, I think specifically with puppies, they go for their vaccinations.
Yes.
Just check. And yeah. if you're not sure, you can get referred. You can get yeah. referred to a specialist. Ask your vet. We are there. That's what we're there for. That's yeah. what we're trained for. I think it's extremely important.
Yeah, no. Well, Dr. Duplessis, thank you. That has been an absolutely fascinating show. I've certainly learned a lot. And listeners, I hope that you have been listening and have stayed with us and have picked up lots of info. We will be back next week.
Thanks, Ainsley.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is CliffCentral.com.